housing rebound. Is it for real or just our imagination?
And the things you got to do, apparently, to get doctors in other countries to prescribe your drugs. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, August 8th. And coming up, we're going to look into something kind of odd, which is that even though we have an 8.3% unemployment rate right now, the Labor Department just told us that there are a lot of job openings out there.
We'll also talk about all these apps that are being put out by the presidential campaigns running for president. Apparently these days, there's an app for that. That and a bunch more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Mortgage giant Freddie Mac brought in $3 billion in profits last quarter. That's the largest profit for Freddie since the government took over the lender 4 years ago. As Marketplace's Eve Tro reports, it's just one of several numbers that suggest the U.S. housing market is on the way up.
More people are paying their mortgages in full and on time. According to the credit reporting firm TransUnion, about 5.5% of homeowners are late with their payments. That's the lowest in 3 years. Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics. He says there are still a lot of homeowners in the middle of the foreclosure process, but
with more people making their payments on time, ultimately, that'll mean fewer foreclosures, and that's good, ultimately, for house prices.
Other signs point to higher home prices. The research firm CoreLogic saw a jump of more than 6% from April to June. Government-backed lender Freddie Mac calculated similar gains. University of Maryland economist Peter Morisi says that's because more homes on the market are normal sales, not foreclosure sales.
So we're dealing with real supply, actually folks reselling their homes, and fewer bank sales.
Those command a higher price. And Morisi says, as rents go up around the country, buying a house looks better than it has the past few years. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Well, stock market started off the day on a down note, not that far down, but, 0.2% or so for the S&P 500. And European markets were also lower today. But, of course, yesterday we had a big upswing in the market. So it's just kind of that seesaw effect right now, Jeff.
Well, this might have a little to do with it today. A number of reports out of Europe this morning were gloomy on a number of fronts. Bank of England forecasts that the UK economy will not grow at all in the coming quarter. And across the English Channel, the French central bank says the euro's second largest economy, France, of course, is headed for its own recession. And Germany's being infected by all this through its exports, which fell in June. Also, we have some new numbers from the Labor Department. American worker productivity grew faster in the second quarter than economists had expected. Specifically, Americans were 1.6% more productive, Jeremy, than they were at the same time last year.
Also, and here's the weird part, job openings jumped to a four-year high in June, 3.7 million, which of course seems very strange considering we learned less than a week ago that the country has an 8.3% unemployment rate right now. So to help us make sense of this, we've got John Sylvia on the line from Charlotte. He's chief economist with Wells Fargo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so explain this discrepancy, John. I mean, how is it possible that with this kind of unemployment rate that U.S. job openings are at a four-year high?
Well, I think the dominant factor is the skills mismatch. You have a lot of unemployed people, and we can think about a lot of people in the construction business, for example, building the housing, et cetera, and then manufacturing, low and semi-skilled manufacturing. Once they become unemployed, it's unlikely they're going to be able to take jobs in the professional and business services, education and health. Those sectors require a very, very different set of skills.
Well, if part of the mismatch is due to people in construction and manufacturing, does there need to be a new push for a rebirth of the manufacturing industry in this country or just more training for those people to move into other professions?
Yeah, I would emphasize the training. The modern manufacturing worker is not the assembly line worker turning a screw like they were in the old days. The modern manufacturing worker oftentimes operates with a laptop or manipulates a screen or something. So I think it's retraining workers to deal with the modern 21st century manufacturing.
Is the mismatch getting worse or better right now? Are there more job openings compared to the amount of people who are out of work?
Yeah, if you look at the imbalance between unemployment and vacancies, It has gotten worse over the last year or two, in part because we're not generating and getting these people the training that they need to be competitive. Now, you know, for a lot of young people just out of college, that's not true. Young people are adaptable. They're willing to try things. They're easy to move. So what you see here is a rising problem among people in their late 30s, 40s, and 50s, but a diminishing problem in terms of young people.
John Sylvia, chief economist at Wells Fargo, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You got it. Thank you.
Well, as American Airlines winds its way through bankruptcy, some of its union workers are voting on new contract offers. We're waiting today for the results of the voting by two big labor unions representing pilots and maintenance crews. Next week, a judge is going to decide if the company can throw out its old labor contracts and impose even more severe cuts on the workers. Seems dramatic, but as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, the bankruptcy has been almost invisible so far to Americans' customers.
Back in February, American Airlines said it planned to lay off 13,000 employees, about 15% of its workforce. Since then, there have been layoffs, reservation agents and skycaps in Arizona, managers in Tulsa, but nothing close to 13,000.
It takes time to revise your schedules and change your route structures.
Aviation expert Richard Gritta at the University of Portland says cutting back on service will eventually lead to job cuts. But he says the layoff announcements also have a strategic value. American Airlines wants union workers to accept deep cuts to wages and benefits. The threat is vote yes or the company will impose unilateral cutbacks that are even worse.
The history of union-management relationship in this industry has been terrible.
Many of Americans' union workers apparently hope U.S. Airways will fly in like a white knight, merge with their bankrupt employer, and stem the layoffs that are still coming. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Bad weather is affecting global tea prices. The cost of good quality black tea has shot up 41% on the wholesale market this year. Christopher Worth has the story now from the tea paradise that we commonly call London.
At the Little Portland Cafe in central London, Philip Theophilou rattles off a list of teas.
We've got regular tea, regular English tea.
The price, just about a dollar a cup. 9 out of 10 people in Britain drink tea. It's practically the national beverage. And Theophilou says his customers will likely be concerned about a price hike.
We sell a lot of tea in England, so I'm sure the rising cost of tea is going to be quite distressing.
Alex Beckett of the research firm Mintel says recent bad weather in top tea-producing countries such as Kenya and India are to blame for the recent spike in tea prices. But he doesn't expect it to hit tea-loving Brits too hard.
The British supermarkets here are going to battle and do all they can to keep the shelf prices as low as possible because we need our tea.
But some analysts have read the tea leaves and say prices could climb even higher. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Well, if you're more of a coffee drinker, we've got an item for you, too. It's not like paying for your coffee at Starbucks is all that complicated, but it's about to get even easier. Imagine paying just by maybe saying your name into your smartphone, maybe while it's still in your pocket. Sounds kind of cool. That's one scenario when Starbucks launches a major payments partnership with a young company called Square. Here's our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore.
When you pay for your grande cappuccino, you probably don't think about where your money goes after you've swiped your card. But Jack Dorsey does. He runs Square, a startup that will install its one-touch payment app at Starbucks.
So every Starbucks in the United States will be able to accept Pay with Square, and also, of course, the Starbucks app.
But it's more than that. Square will handle the millions of purchases that Starbucks customers make with plastic. Nick Holland is with the Yankee Group. He predicts mobile payments will grow fivefold in the next 3 years. Square wants to capture that.
The places that we're using this would be anywhere where there's high volume of low-value transactions. So your quick service restaurants, convenience stores, gas stations.
Square founder Dorsey is a Starbucks customer himself.
Right now I like the refreshers. Have you tried them? It's almost like an energy drink.
And you can guess how he's going to pay for it after today. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Well, if you needed any more evidence that there are way too many TV channels right now, here it is. BSkyB, the British satellite broadcaster, is adding a new channel in October that will do nothing but play the 22 James Bond movies on repeat for a month.
That sounds like TNT when I was in college, I remember. It seemed like nonstop Bond movies.
One radio station when I was growing up that changed formats, and for like a week in between formats, they just played We Will Rock You over and over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And it was probably the most... I now can't listen to that song anymore.
That doesn't make that as much sense.
But anyway, they're doing this to mark the 50th anniversary of the Bond franchise, so at least they do have a reason for the madness.
Hang in there until that George Lazenby Bond movie rolls around every 22 movies. And what better to go with your vodka martini, shaken, not stirred, of course, than a lobster and caviar burger from Wendy's. At the end of this month, three different variations on these ingredients are going to go on sale at Wendy's in Japan. We have, Jeremy, the straight-up lobster claw meat burger, the lobster salad and caviar burger, and just in case you're not ready for something completely new, a burger featuring a beef patty with lobster meat on top of it. Sounds great. And these things come at a bit of a price. $14 will be the cheapest of these options.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
With Election Day now less than 3 months away, the campaigns of both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama have amped up, and one of their newest feats, mobile apps. We hear about a new one, seems like every day. The Obama campaign app has already caught some criticism for a feature that lets you see little flags on a map that shows you where all the Democrats are in your neighborhood. Meanwhile, the Romney campaign has created an app specifically designed to reveal the name of his running mate once that person is picked.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra is Peter Ubertasio. He is a member of the Political Science Department at Stonehill College in Massachusetts. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Well, so tell us about these apps that the campaigns have come out with thus far. What do you think of them so far?
Well, I think that the campaigns are trying to stay on top of the latest technology. They will do just about anything to reach every last voter possible. So if there's a chance that one of these apps might succeed in bringing someone to their side or in energizing one of their current supporters, I think that they'll go ahead and do it. I don't expect they're going to have much of an impact on the election. But it's just another way for campaigns to reach out to voters.
I can't help but wonder how much voters are the actual target of these apps and how much it's maybe people like us, because so many people talk about the apps.
Right. I know. I think that's a very fair question. And I think that they're probably designed to reach out to supporters as opposed to voters who haven't made up their mind. I think there are a lot of independently minded voters out there who are going about their daily business and thinking to themselves, you know what I need on my phone? I need Mitt's VP app, because that's something that's keeping me up at night.
Well, is this just sort of an extension of what was going on 4 years ago when the big thing was that, President Obama, when he was campaigning, would get the names and email addresses of everybody who showed up at the event so that he just had that information, could send them out little, pings and get them to send money back? I mean, is this just the next way to do that?
It is another way to do that, absolutely. And I the Obama campaign was organizationally very, very smart. So it's not only about getting their names, email addresses, and then having them send you money. It's about recruiting volunteers, because the most successful way to win is not through mobile technology. It's not through advertising. It's getting people to the polls and going door to door to do that. It's very time consuming, quite labor intensive to do that. But the Obama campaign did it very well. And so these apps, again, they're not going to be the deciding factor in an election. But to the extent that they can help, even at the margins, mobilize some volunteers, and I think the campaigns view them as useful.
You know, the other day I was walking around listening to my Pandora app, and up came a Mitt Romney ad on Pandora. And I thought that was kind of interesting that's a place where he's targeting some campaign money.
I think it's very smart for the campaigns to do that. I would suspect that in short order, we will start seeing personalized ads on our DVR. The technology exists for campaigns really to drill down and find their natural base of supporters through all of these devices that we have. And so it wouldn't surprise me that we're going to start hearing and seeing more and more of that. It's very little money to put together an app. So why not? I mean, again, to the extent that it helps to drive a narrative for both campaigns and can, you know, potentially help them attract some volunteers or maybe some supporters or to jazz up the supporters they have for relatively short money, it makes a lot of sense to do that.
These apps are pretty simple. The Mitt Romney VP app, perhaps simplest of all, it exists for essentially one function, nominally anyway, which is to get the announcement first when he has a vice presidential pick. Can you foresee a next step here? I mean, surely we must go somewhere more interesting and engaging from these very simple apps.
Well, that's a dilemma because these folks want to be elected into a small R Republican system of government. And these apps encourage a personal relationship between candidates and office holders that really ceases to exist in any significant way once governing begins. I think that's a negative feature of these attempts to personalize campaigns and to personalize presidents. You know, when presidents make decisions in the Oval Office, they're not looking at their apps and they're not looking for feedback based upon them. So I'm not sure that we can go much deeper than we have at the moment because the system of government that we have in place does not encourage that kind of personalization of the office.
Political scientist Peter Ubertasio at Stonehill College in Massachusetts, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Apple and Google are expected to be major bidders at an auction today, not for some rare artwork, but for patents from Eastman Kodak, which put 1,100 patents up for sale after entering bankruptcy earlier this year. And of course, Kodak isn't the only game in town when it comes to patents, which have become central to the fight over the future of the tech industry. That, Jeff, it turns out, is great news for patent lawyers.
Surprise, surprise.
Here is Sabri Benashour of Station WAMU in Washington.
Alice Ahn is at her desk at law firm Covington & Burling, reading from a 4-inch thick book.
It stores tags and contents together in a tree structure.
Sound like Greek? Yeah, that's because it's patent law. Ahn graduated law school in 2010 and was hired in no time. Actually, in, like, negative time.
I was hired before I graduated from law school.
Not so much for a lot of her recent classmates. The employment rate for new law grads has hit its lowest point since 1994, except in Ahn's field, IP law, especially patent law. Why?
You know, at least in the smartphone area, it's become World War III, I guess you could call it.
Max Grant is a partner at Latham & Watkins, which grew its IP practice 40% in just the last year and a half. And he adds it's not just cell phones.
Just about anybody that you can think of, if you walk into Circuit City or your local Verizon store and you sort of look on the wall and see what's available, those are the companies that are being involved in a lot of these fights.
Given that so many tech companies are in Asia or doing business there, speaking an Asian language helps a lot. Kurt Kalia is a partner at Covington & Burling, where Ahn works.
If you have a case that involves 6 million pages of documents in Korean, it would be astronomically expensive to try to translate all of that.
Remember that patent law book Alice Ahn was reading out of? She can read it in Korean.
HTML로 만들어진 문서를 만들고
and Japanese.
HTML와 XML.
That plus a background in computer science means she and lawyers with her skills are pretty set. And patent fights are likely to continue for as long as tech companies have something to fight over, given that two of the top five most profitable companies in the world are tech companies, it's going to be well. I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
Well, industry watchers say the drug company Pfizer has just joined a kind of a dubious top 10 list, Jeremy. It just became number 6 on the list of companies forced to give up profits because of foreign bribery. Pfizer just agreed to pay $60 million to the Department of Justice and the SEC. Pfizer makes Lipitor, which is one of their best-known drugs. The charge is violating the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. In a nutshell, here's what's going on. Pfizer's drug sales reps paid bribes to get Pfizer drugs used by doctors in countries like China, Russia, and Bulgaria. Eric Gordon is a professor at the law school and the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you.
What kinds of supposedly shady things were Pfizer's reps doing to win business in some of these countries?
You know, some of the things they were doing were actually pitiful. They were bribing doctors with items such as eyeglasses, iPhones, trips to medical conferences that they couldn't otherwise afford.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are not Beverly Hills doctors. These are doctors that are quite low paid and are apparently very cheaply bribed.
I remember something about a point system, I guess, that the doctors could rack up points as they prescribed Pfizer drugs. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. In China, you know, you accumulated enough points, and I guess, you know, depending on how many points you got, you either got a pair of kind of chintzy eyeglasses or some designer eyeglasses.
So this kind of stuff is not kosher, according to the U.S. Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And Pfizer, as I understand it, essentially turned itself in, right? How surprising is that?
Well, it's not real surprising because the penalties can be pretty severe. So you're better off going in and saying, look, here's what we discovered. We didn't know what was going on. We don't condone it. We're firing the people and we will cooperate with you. And then you get a relatively bearable settlement. And in this case, even a little pat on the back from the government, which said, well, Pfizer really did a good job of helping us investigate this, which is a lot better than having the government hate you and want a big fine and want to send somebody to jail.
The U.S. Justice Department suggests there could be more investigations where this one came from. How widespread do you think this kind of stuff is in other countries?
I think it's really widespread because in many countries, the only way you can do business with the government is to bribe government officials. And in many countries, healthcare is run by the government. When you add those two things together, you have to expect that there's going to be corruption in a large number of countries across a large number of drug companies. Otherwise, they just can't do business there.
Eric Gordon with the University of Michigan's Law School and Ross School of Business. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Well, imagine you're walking down the street and there is a box in front of you with stuff in it, free stuff. I would probably call the police, Jeff, but you know what? For the past year, boxes like that have been showing up across Europe, which are full of things that people leave and others take. And now the Give Box is coming to North America. Judith Ritter has the story from Montreal.
These regulars here at the Give Box tell me they just can't believe their luck.
I found many things from the television to a pair of socks, perfumes, books, vinyls.
Yesterday I was perusing the other Give Box and someone left a giant pen.
I found myself a nice hat. It's just a beautiful old hat made in Canada. It's a black velvet hat with a nice
feather.
I love it.
About a month ago, this tall wood cabinet turned up next to a grocery store in the Mile End neighborhood of Montreal. A sign on the cabinet said Give Box, and it invited people to exchange things. But Frederick Nissen, the one who brought the Give Box idea from Europe to Montreal, says there's more to it.
Bring something special. In fact, if you can bring something a bit artistic as well, that you did by yourself, then the exchange brings it to another level.
It's that other level that intrigues Ismail Olvik. He's the fellow who found the feathered hat.
It's really about the beauty of leaving something to the world. It's really about passing on these physical things to people who need them or wants to create with them or use them.
And there are stories left in there, too, in a guest book. Someone says his mom wants him to read more, so please leave him a Norwegian novel. Someone else writes she has no object to leave, so she'll leave a cooking tip. The box itself has become a neighborhood personality. Parisian Jimmy Gravelet works nearby.
When the box came, first, it was just a wooden box, a piece of wood. But the more you open the doors, the more you open the box, the more you want to open the box. It's like an addiction, you know? Yeah, it's like falling in love.
Ah, so French. I'm Judith Ritter for Marketplace.
Well, now to some new research from the University of Georgia about cats.
Serious research.
Yes, that's right. Cats. Scientists strapped some lightweight video cameras onto 60 house cats to see what exactly they are up to when their owners let them loose.
This is awesome.
And here are the results, courtesy of the LA Times. 44% of the cats went on attempted killing sprees.
Yeah.
85%
of what?
Well, we don't know.
Of people?
Probably mice. No, I'm guessing mice, birds, whatever, yeah. Rabbits. 85% engaged in dangerous behaviors like crossing streets and exploring tight spaces that they could get stuck in.
Hmm.
And four of the cats, this is my favorite, keep a second family on the side.
they're cats. I guess we can cut them a little bit of slack.
I guess so.
And finally, one of our occasional, more than occasional, maybe lists of cities. We love them here on the podcast. And this is kind of a fun one. A survey of the worst American city names. I imagine they do this one every now and then and the same towns keep turning up. But it's always funny. Boring Oregon.
Which we just had a story on from Stephen Beard about dull and boring. Dull, a town, I guess, in Scotland or England, which has teamed up with Boring Oregon for a tourism partnership.
I didn't hear it. That story must have been scintillating.
Yes.
Belchertown, Massachusetts is another good one. Monkey's Eyebrow, Kentucky, which is not horrible. I think that's just kind of cool. All those made the top 10. But here's number one. A little, imagine a drum roll here. Toad Suck, Arkansas. I don't think you could do any worse than Toad Suck, Arkansas.
Well, in just regular old New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.